Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The constitutional right to petition the government has slowly been tightened in our state, but how does Michigan compare to other states? Then State Representative Brian Banks was recently in court again. Has his party been trying to look the other way? But first, the Democrats are gathering for their state convention in Lansing tomorrow, and the Republicans are holding their convention in Grand Rapids today and tomorrow. Joining us as they do most Fridays are Ken Sikkema, senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants and former Republican majority leader in the state Senate, and Susan Demas, the publisher at Inside Michigan Politics. Ken, I saw yesterday the Donald Trump campaign named its congressional district representatives, some current legislators among the list. So that moves the Trump presidential campaign ahead in the state. So what are the jobs that Michigan Republicans have to accomplish this weekend?
Well, I think one of the undercurrents is going to be, can they get Republicans unified behind their presidential nominee? Because there are Republicans both in Michigan and around the country that have said they're not going to vote for Trump. So part of the challenge for Republicans this weekend is to give the at least the appearance of being unified and saying that Michigan is in play.
They also have Supreme Court candidates, Board of Education, university boards, folks like that down ballot. They have to make those decisions this weekend as well, right?
That's right. There are some nominations for Supreme Court, Board of Ed, U of M, Wayne State, MSU trustees, and that's really not going to be the big issue. I think it's about Trump and unifying the party, and then there's going to be an undercurrent about the 2018 gubernatorial election.
Susan, my colleague Steve Carmody reported the backers of Senator Bernie Sanders say they'll extend their, in quotations, revolution. Sanders' backers have already helped shape the party's proposed platform. What will that mean for Democrats in Michigan?
I wouldn't be surprised if they have a presence at the convention tomorrow in Lansing. At this point, I think Democrats are focused on choosing their down-ballot nominees, firing up the troops with Texas Senator Wendy Davis, who, you know, was kind of an icon of the reproductive rights movement.
Right. She's keynote speaker. Yeah.
Right. She will be the keynote speaker, which is a pretty big contrast to the keynote speaker over at the Republican convention with former ambassador to the UN, John Bolton, under George W. Bush. And I do think the Democrats are, you know, focused on uniting behind Clinton, which has largely happened, but really looking at 2018 when they are very eager to retake the governorship.
So you don't think that they'll have the same kind of unity problems that the Republicans have? I mean, the Sanders folks say they're going to be there and they're going to make their progressive policies an important part of the Democratic Party in Michigan.
These conventions tend to be inside baseball. This is for the really big activists to attend and pay attention to, unlike the Republican National Convention or the Democratic National Convention, where, you know, you see speeches on national television and people are aware of them. These platform fights are things that most voters are not really keyed into. And, you know, the Democrats certainly have issues with unity. You know, there are a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters who are still not very happy with Hillary Clinton and want the agenda for the party pushed very far left. But I think that their voices get magnified a lot because there are some very vocal Sanders supporters out there. If you look at the polling, Democrats have really largely coalesced around Clinton, just like any other nominee. The difference with the Republicans is that you're not seeing that with Donald Trump. You know, he is only getting about 83% of Republicans, and there have been such high-profile defections. And so, you know, it's inevitable that that's going to spill over into their convention this weekend with Democrats. It's more of a typical convention, I think, where you're always going to have some disagreements, but with the Republicans, they have a real issue.
I want to change subjects on both of you. The Attorney General, Bill Schuette, and Governor Rick Snyder's administration are fighting in the court. Last night, Schuette's office issued this statement, and that is, quote, Genesee County judge has recognized Michigan Department of Health and Human Services is the subject of a criminal investigation and should not be performing any investigation of the Legionella or lead poisoning in Flint. The judge authorized this protective order to preserve the evidence in the ongoing criminal investigation. So it's basically saying the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services shouldn't be dealing with anything that the Genesee County Health Department has to deal with. What's going on here? Ken, let's start with you.
Well, we have right now we've got dueling press releases over a confidential court order out of Genesee County. And frankly, I think one of the issues in an age of transparency is why do we have these confidential orders? If this were an email issue, the media would be all over it in terms of the need for transparency. And so we don't know because it is confidential. But on the surface of it, if the Department of Health and Human Services, if they are being prevented from doing their public health responsibility when it comes to Legionella, the cause of it, and how do you deal with it up in Genesee County, I think that's a huge problem. I don't think a criminal investigation over the past action of some employees should be allowed to get in the way of a department exercising its public health responsibility. But I quickly add, we just don't know what's going on because this court order is confidential.
Susan?
Yeah, and right now, like you mentioned, they're doing press releases from Attorney General Bill Schuette, who's a Republican, and you know, he and the Genesee County prosecutor, David Layton, ironically, they ran against each other in 2010. They are on one side, and their claim is that this is not going to hurt public health at all, whereas Governor Rick Snyder and his administration are claiming that the order will do exactly that, and it's frankly punitive. And so I agree with Ken. Given its confidentiality, it's really hard to make too many statements as to what's going on here.
I'm just wondering how this affects Flint residents and their health concerns because of Flint's water. Anybody have an answer to that one? I guess we should get them
well,
on.
Well, I guess, and once again, I think both Susan and I are a little hesitant to make judgments because this order is confidential. But I'm going to say that if the Department of Health and Human Services is being prevented from doing its public health job because of past activity from some employees, I think that's a problem.
That's Ken Sikkema. He's Senior Policy Fellow at Public Sector Consultants. Susan Demas is the publisher of Inside Michigan Politics. Thanks to both of you for talking.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. We've been thinking about the kind of people you might like to meet on the radio. I mean, we have a lot of authors, musicians, politicians, and policy wonks, but how about those people who make things? Artisans, the people who repair things, they build things that we use. Well, our next stop in our series, Artisans of Michigan, is Allen Park.
And so what I'll do is carve on them for a while and then pick up the soundboard and tap on it and see how it responds to my tapping.
Meet Gary Zimnicki. We're in his workshop behind his house. Gary's passion is making guitars.
It started out as just kind of a casual interest. I wanted a guitar and couldn't afford it, so I built one, and it was the coolest thing ever, you know. I never thought I could do such a thing. It was an electric guitar, a solid body. And a friend saw it and said, oh, could you build me one?
Zimnicki says he graduated from making electric guitars from old butcher block to better material, and then he decided to get serious. He wanted to build an acoustic guitar, and that was different.
Way different, and I think I built 6 or 8 solid bodies before I got up the nerve to try an acoustic guitar. And this would have been like maybe around 1979 by that point. And I found one book in a music store on building guitars, acoustic guitars. So I bought the book and that's what I learned from.
He started making guitars, then mandolins and ukuleles. It got to the point where really that's all he wanted to do.
It was a combination of being really dissatisfied with my day job and getting more and more in demand that allowed me to make the transition.
That, and his wife said, go ahead, do it. I'll go to work. So she got insurance benefits and all of that. So Zimnicki has been making instruments full-time for 15 years now. Lately, he's been experimenting a little bit. With all the houses and buildings being demolished in Detroit, he started using salvaged wood he gets from Reclaim Detroit.
It's 100 years old. It's been sitting around that long, most of what Reclaim Detroit is salvaging. And over time, wood becomes more and more dense. All the resins in it crystallize, and it just becomes harder and harder to work with. So I've burned up saw blades in just a matter of 4 or 5 cuts, just enough cuts to get maple for the back and sides of one guitar. And then my saw blade's no good anymore.
It's more work. He has to piece floorboards together. But in the end, it sounds great. Oh, and I'm supposed to tell you, Zimnicki says he's a guitar maker. Guitar player, not as much. Zimnicki says it's that sound that keeps him happy that he made this his career.
Being able to listen to somebody play a musical instrument and remembering when that instrument was just a stack of wood, rough cut timber sitting on a bench, I can't tell you what a great feeling that is. Even at this point, I've built close to 350 instruments, and I still am thrilled to hear somebody play their new guitar when they get it. It's just a great feeling.
Gary Zimnicki of Allen Park, the latest in our Artisans of Michigan series. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. It seems like years since it's been here. Here comes the sun. Here comes the sun. I see. It's all right. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. As a citizen, you have a right to petition the government for redress of grievances. At the state level, that right and the right to put referenda on the ballot can be restricted or, in some cases, circumvented. Paul Jacob has been active in the Libertarian Party and currently serves on the boards of Citizens in Charge, a nonpartisan group working to protect and expand voter initiative rights, and the Citizens in Charge Foundation, a charitable foundation conducting research on the initiative process, educating the public, and litigating to defend petition rights. He was the founder of both of those groups. Let's establish a baseline here. How does Michigan compare to other states in the ability of voters to petition government or get referenda on the ballot?
Well, Michigan has a referendum process, which 16 states do. It has an initiative process for both constitutional amendments and statutory measures. And so it has the various components that you would want. And so it's in the better section, the upper half of states that have the initiative. And of course, only 26 states have either initiative, referendum, or both.
And you said we're one of 16 who have both?
That's right.
Wow. So recently, Michigan's legislature has implemented a 100-day time period for signature collecting to get something on the ballot. Groups have indicated that's way too restrictive. How common is such a restriction in other states that actually allow it?
Well, the states are all over the map. I know people in Arkansas who just filed an initiative that could go on the ballot, and they can collect signatures from now until July of 2018 or 2020 or 2022. There's no real limit whatsoever. Of course, some of those signatures, the people may have moved to another state by the time you turn them in, but there's no limit on how long they can petition. Then there are states like Oklahoma that require a high percentage, 15%, to do a constitutional amendment and only give you 90 days, and that makes it much, much more difficult. Michigan has always had, you know, the 180-day policy, but it was a policy. It wasn't the law, and it's long been discussed that you could collect signatures in a longer period of time. They just wouldn't have the presumption of validity. In other words, the state might say, you have to prove that these signatures gathered 200 days ago are actually valid, instead of having that presumption going in and having to be found invalid.
In your view, how reasonable is that restriction of 180 days?
I don't think it's completely unreasonable to have a restriction. I think it's better policy not to have it. I don't think it really serves any compelling interest for democracy. Obviously, if you take too long a period of time, the signatures aren't going to have the same level of validity, and you risk turning in a lot of signatures, but a number of them having no longer been valid because the people moved. It almost takes care of itself naturally. 180 days isn't terribly short. But again, what is often not seen here is this is a process designed for the average person and people to get together and do it. If you're a big corporate interest or a big union, you've got lobbyists in the Capitol. You have the ability to hire professional circulators and get these measures on the ballot that you want. But this process is really designed for people who don't have all those advantages. And so I think we always have to err on the side of giving people more access to the process, more opportunity to put things on the ballot. You know, it's very difficult. Candidates in different states, candidates running for president, getting on primary ballots, have had an awful lot of trouble sometimes getting 1,000 signatures in a state or 10,000, much less the 500,000 signatures you need in a lot of these states like Michigan and Ohio or California or Florida.
The Michigan legislature has also been attaching appropriations to laws. That prohibits citizen initiatives from repealing those laws. And in many of these cases, these appropriations are not really necessary. This is seen by some in the state as a devious way to circumvent the citizens' rights to challenge the government. What do you think of that maneuver?
Well, I think it is devious. There's no question, you know, with right to work, and that's a controversial issue. People can have solid opinions on both sides of that issue, but with right to work in Michigan, they slapped an appropriations into the measure that really didn't have to be there. And there was a initiative put forth, which my organization, Citizens in Charge, endorsed, which would have changed that. Unfortunately, not enough signatures were gathered. There wasn't the resources to hire circulators. But what should happen is that if you want to wall off appropriations from a referendum, then do that. But allow the rest of the legislation to be put to the voters in a referendum, and that would allow voters more access. There are several states that have what's called an emergency clause or a safety clause, and they can put on any bill a little add-on that says this is an emergency, and therefore it's not subject to referendum. And there are now states like Colorado where a majority of the bills passed every session are emergencies.
Well, we're seeing this appropriations maneuver happening more often than we've ever seen it before. It's becoming a great concern among many people who think it does circumvent citizens' rights. I want to talk about some of the stuff you see in other states. I was told that you see some strange requirements to petition the governor in different states. Arkansas, for example, they mandate a criminal background check for everybody who's doing petition gathering. I mean, what's the purpose behind that?
Well, they actually just mandate it for paid circulators, but of course there have been very few measures that have qualified for the ballot in Arkansas that don't use paid circulators. And what happened is they alleged that there was quite a bit of fraud back in 2012, and from what I have looked at, some of the different petitions, I was actually an expert witness in a court case there, I tend to suspect that there was fraud. But what happened is instead of prosecuting the people who may have committed fraud, they didn't prosecute anybody. Instead, they went to the legislature, and the legislature used it as an excuse to really try to wreck the process and make it more difficult. And it's something that people have to understand across the board. When a case goes to court, the judge, you know, has an idea that the legislature passed this law with good motivations.
Well, I got to tell you, in this state, criminal background check would mean a lot of our former politicians would no longer be able to collect signatures.
Well, it's absolutely ridiculous to think that a First Amendment right, you wouldn't be able to exercise it until you had spent money to have a criminal background check. It's ridiculous. And it's designed specifically for that purpose, to make it tougher for people to get things on the ballot. And we all talk about democracy, but the folks in power, don't like democracy unless they think they're going to win the vote. And we see it. We see liberal legislatures. We see conservative legislatures. Who's ever in power has had a tendency to try to block the initiative process because it's the way that folks who are not in power can put something on the ballot and go directly to the people. I think that's a great thing. According to every poll taken in every state I've ever seen, the people think that's a great thing. But frankly, politicians don't think that's a great thing at all.
That's Paul Jacob. He's with Citizens in Charge, a petition-gathering watchdog group. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Let me ask you something. Do you know any twins? Some researchers at Michigan State University know more than 28,000 twins. The Michigan State University Twin Registry is part of the Department of Psychology at the school. Alex Burt is a professor of psychology there. Your project is following twins, a lot of them. Why?
Twins are a brilliant natural experiment, sort of a gift of nature. They allow you to parse apart genetic and environmental influences and correlational studies in ways that you just otherwise really cannot do or can't do well.
Yeah, I read the findings from studying twins have been influential in detecting and treating various diseases or psychological disorders. Why are twins able to do that when others are not?
Twin studies do is they leverage the differential degree of genetic relatedness between identical twins and fraternal twins.
I'm going to have to ask you what that means.
Genetic relatedness is basically the extent to which you share segregating genes or the genes that vary across people. Typical first-degree relatives share about 50% of their genes, so you, by definition, share 50% with your biological mother, 50% with your biological father. You share about 50% with each of your full siblings, 25% with grandparents, with aunts and uncles. And you can look at any familial relationship in that way. You can figure out what proportion of genes they're likely to share. Twins are really interesting because fraternal twins are just like regular full siblings in the sense that they are from two eggs and two sperm. They share about 50% of their segregating genes. Identical twins, some people describe them as nature's clones. It's a single human conception, so one egg and one sperm. And then for reasons we don't understand, that single embryo will split into two prior to implantation. So this happens very, very early on in the pregnancy, typically before the woman has even missed a menstrual cycle. And voila, you have two separate people with exact copies of each other's DNA.
So if you've got identical twins, these two perfectly matched people, I guess then it's easier to tell if they have different environmental experiences or different traumatic things happening or, you know, psychologically serious things happen to them. You can contrast and compare?
Yep, that's exactly right. So that is one of the very cool, if you will, scientifically cool features about identical twins is that they allow you to study environmental influences in effectively a causal way, which is for correlational designs, you know, correlation does not equal causation, except in this particular case, if you can follow them longitudinally and with a large enough sample and so forth.
You also want to get fraternal twins to sign up as well, right?
Yes, we do. And that's because twin designs don't just rely on identical twins. So identical twins are ideal for identifying environmental influences. But for identifying genetic influences and other environmental influences, you really want to have fraternal twins in the study as well. Quite a simple design, actually. You give questionnaires, or you could look at experiences or so forth, but let's just say questionnaires on a particular trait, let's say depression. So you would give many twins in a sample a depression questionnaire, and then you would look and compare sibling similarity separately by identical and fraternal twins. You would look to see, are identical twins more similar to each other than our fraternal twins? And if they are, because identical twins share 100% of their genes, fraternal twins share only 50% of their segregating genes, we infer that there's a genetic influence on that trait, depression in this case. If identical twins are not more similar than fraternal twins, we infer, okay, genes must not matter for this trait because it doesn't matter that these twins here, even though they're genetically identical, they're not more similar as a result. And so it allows you to pull apart and decompose, is the word we use, genetic from environmental influences. You can also look at interactions between genes and environments. It's a pretty fascinating design.
How unique is the Michigan State University Twin Registry in studying this kind of health research?
There's several twin registries nationally and internationally. Certainly in the United States, it is definitely one of the larger twin registries. But I think even internationally, it's one of the larger twin registries.
I was wondering how you managed to get more than 28,000 twins to sign up for the registry. How did that start?
Dr. Kelly Klump, who co-directs the registry with me. Both Kelly Klump and I went to University of Minnesota, which is sort of a hotbed for twin research.
Minnesota Twins, of course. Yeah, so.
Yeah. We weren't there at the same time, but we studied with some of the same professors. And when we both ended up at Michigan State, even though we don't study the same disorders, it just made sense for both of us to sort of, you know, pool our shared expertise and develop something. And so it sort of started out as the collaboration that would help us recruit twins for each of our independent research projects, but it just kind of blossomed as it was going on. It was just clear it was a good idea, and it was generating interest, and other researchers around campus and around the country were interested in trying to recruit twins out of the registry and seeing if they wanted to participate in other research studies. And so it just became, you know, I'd like to claim that we just had this brilliant insight, but it happened organically, I would say.
So you're also researching the children of twins. How's that helpful to your research?
You know, again, you're leveraging different degrees of genetic relatedness. So the children of a set of dizygotic twins are genetically cousins. They have one set of their parents or siblings. Monozygotic twins, again, it's quite interesting. Genetically speaking, the respective children of a set of monozygotic twins are actually half-siblings genetically, even though that's not the way they live their life and that's not the way they conceive of themselves. Let's say you're talking about a pair of female identical twins. Genetically, they are identical. Their children are as genetically related to their mother as they are to their aunt. 50%, right?
Okay, you're blowing my mind now because I hadn't thought about this in the past like this. I'm glad somebody is. So they become very valuable in the same way that fraternal twins would be.
But they have the additional piece that you can also look at intergenerational genetic transmission.
Right.
You've got multiple generations. It's sort of taking the twin design and adding to it.
Alex Burt is a professor at the Michigan State University Twin Registry, which is part of the Department of Psychology there. Thanks very much for talking with us. This has just been kind of mind-bending.
Well, my pleasure.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. There are several people who've been called heroes in uncovering the Flint water crisis. You've heard those voices many times on this station. But a new book, a children's book, makes the argument that kids are the heroes because Flint kids have had to learn new ways to eat, to drink, to live their lives. The title of Gail Glover's book is Learning, Recycling, and Becoming Little Heroes. Now, I understand this didn't start out as a children's book. You had something else in mind. What was that?
I actually authored another book, and it's called Flint, The Death and Rebirth of a City. That book actually talks about a lot of different avenues about the Flint water crisis. So it tackles the governmental problems that happened. It talks about the residents of Flint, Michigan, and how they have had to deal with the water crisis. So in doing the research for that book is how I started this project.
I'm wondering how this idea came to you while you were doing that research.
Well, actually, by right, I am a children's book author. And so in just doing the research for it, I kept asking people, who are the true heroes in the Flint water crisis? And people had some amazing answers, but no one specifically talked about the children. So as a children author, it kind of resonated to me, and I kind of just came up with this plan.
There's a lot of confusion in Flint about whether the filters are working, taking the lead out of the tap water. People are confused about the foods that can help mitigate the effects of lead poisoning. How does your book help?
Oh, it helps a lot because it talks specifically about foods that you should eat, foods that are high in iron, low in fat. It talks about exercising, just kind of describing the Flint water crisis in a positive way and how the kids can learn from it and get healthier.
So you talk about the kids adopting all these different healthier lifestyles, the fact that they have to brush their teeth with bottled water and all the things they have to do to make up for the mistakes that were out of their hands. Your book also notes that the kids who volunteered, maybe helping their families donate water to Flint, are also heroes. You know, water donations are falling off now. I mean, the national attention has shifted away from Flint a little bit. I'm wondering what you think can be done about that.
Right. And that was one of the reasons why I actually started writing the adult book, because it felt like people were beginning to forget about what was happening. So I basically think if we just constantly advertise, constantly talk about it, just continue to bring awareness to it so we can't forget, because we cannot forget what happened. We can't forget how to fix it.
Have you had a chance to see kids read it or read it to them? What's been the response?
They loved it. It was amazing. So they absolutely loved it. I've got nothing but positive feedback.
Who did the artwork?
The artwork was a combination of two different artists. One wants to remain anonymous. He did the main characters. And the other one was an alumni of U of M Flint, and her name is Sarah Clark.
And these characters in this book, these are characters you've worked with before in past children's books.
Yes.
Tell me about them.
So it's called the Reach Higher Ed Gang. And so I recently just gave them names. So Teach is a teacher. Kim is a biochemist. Ed stands for education. Scholar is a pediatrician, and Astro is an astrologist and astronomer.
And they guide us through these healthier living points, recognizing that Flint kids really had to change the lifestyle. Gail Glover wrote the children's book, Learning, Recycling, and Becoming Little Heroes, for and about Flint kids dealing with the Flint water crisis. Thanks for coming in and talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Still to come, is one of the state's major political parties ignoring the criminal record of one of its state representatives?
The Democrats are being very hypocritical, asking every Republican elected official to distance himself from Donald Trump, and yet going down and providing financial resources and backing Brian Banks 100%.
You're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The Michigan Freedom Fund's website describes the group as supporting political conservatives who beat up bad policy that favors big business, big banks, big Wall Street bailouts, and big government. Last week, the chairman of the group, Greg McNeely, wrote an opinion piece in the Detroit News calling some Democrats hypocrites because they've been lecturing Republicans about the need to distance themselves from their presidential nominee, Donald Trump, while at the same time making campaign donations to Democratic State Representative Brian Banks. Here's why that's a problem. This week, Representative Banks was arraigned on charges related to using false pay stubs while trying to obtain a bank loan. He faces felony and misdemeanor charges. According to a report by Kathleen Gray at the Free Press, Michigan Attorney General Bill Schuette also charged Banks with being a habitual offender because of prior felonies. Joining us to discuss the opinion piece is Tony Daunt. He's the executive director of Michigan Freedom Fund. So the charges against Representative Banks have been reported. What's the main point of the Michigan Freedom Fund opinion piece here?
Well, I think Greg's column laid it out pretty concisely that you've got an individual who came into office as an 8-time convicted felon and was, through whatever machinations, was allowed to be seated and given a second chance, and has somehow decided that he wanted to throw that away, and he's been involved in additional fraudulent activity. He's got a sexual harassment charge from a former staffer that he settled just recently. You know, these are serious allegations, and it's really troubling that somebody in a position of, you know, dealing with the public fisc, dealing with public policy, who is that reckless in his behavior, that he would not only be allowed, you know, that he would be reelected, that people here in Lansing who are well aware of his behavior would get behind him with 100% of their effort, financially, politically, and through efforts involving going and knocking on doors even. So it's real troubling.
I see two different issues here you're talking about. One is the voters' decision to elect a man who had been convicted before, and despite the charges being known, Banks won his primary race this year, so it appears his constituents are willing to give him the benefit of the doubt, presumed innocent until proven guilty. If the voters want him, and he's not yet been convicted on these later charges, do you believe the voters and the Democrats who've donated to his campaign have some wiggle room to justify their decisions?
No, not at all. Just because you know, my parents always told me, just because you can do something doesn't mean you should do something. And, you know, we all here know how campaigns work. And Brian Banks faced a competitive primary. And so obviously there were people within the district who wanted to remove him. And what's troubling is that the people in Lansing, the leadership, people like Sam Singh from East Lansing, Curtis Hertel from the Lansing area, party leaders like Tim Grimmel and Brandon Dillon, they all are aware of his behavior. They're aware that his constituents mounted a challenge to him, and yet they still came in with their full force of incumbency and defended him, gave him money, and really helped get him over the finish line.
It appears these donations were made well before the most recent charges were filed. Does that change the issue in your view?
No, not at all, because, again, he was convicted, he's an 8-time felon, and he has a sexual, again, sexual harassment is a very serious issue. And not only did he make, you know, sexual innuendos towards his staffer when they were rejected, he then fired him. You know, it's all in the public record. He settled this case between the amount paid to the individual and the amount it cost the state of Michigan to defend him as a state representative. It's $100,000 of taxpayer money that went to basically defend a sexual deviant. And it's really unacceptable.
We don't know that he's a sexual deviant. We haven't, you know, harassment is one thing. Being a deviant is something else. I'm not sure what you're talking about, but let's try to stick to the facts here. I do want to ask you, what do you think the Democrats should be doing now that these most recent charges have been filed and it's public knowledge?
I think they should condemn him in the strongest terms. You alluded to Greg's point about people hammering on, you know, the Democrats hammering on Republicans to distance themselves from their presidential nominee. And from a personal standpoint, I've been very clear in my statements and on my social media page that I am no fan of Donald Trump. And I like to consider myself as being, you know, principled on the issues and principled that if one side does it, doesn't make it okay for the other side. And the Democrats are being very hypocritical, asking every Republican elected official to distance himself from Donald Trump, and yet going down and providing financial resources and backing Brian Banks 100%.
Tony Dodd is the executive director of Michigan Freedom Fund, the conservative group which criticized Democrats for supporting Representative Brian Banks, who faces new felony charges. Stateside contacted Democratic State Party Chair Brandon Dillon's office several times for a response. We did not hear back from him. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. I was reading a release from Michigan State University's MSU Today, and it indicated MSU loses around 300 trees a year to old age, disease, and other factors. That is a direct quote from Dan Brown. He's the wood recovery specialist at MSU's Department of Forestry, and he's here in the studio with us. I know there are a lot of trees on the MSU campus and adjoining land, but 300 trees a year, that's a lot.
So we say 300 trees a year. It's not 300, you know, mature trees that come down. So we're continuously planting new trees on campus. So some of those are newly planted trees that just succumb to disease or drought stress or what have you. And then we do have some large trees that come down, which my program is based off of.
Well, that's what we want to talk about. You have this on-campus sawmill and a kiln for drying the wood. So how unusual is that for a school? We'll get into what you're doing with all this in a little bit, but it just seems to me odd that a school would have a sawmill and a kiln.
It is a unique resource that we have at Michigan State Forestry. Not many schools that I know of have a sawmill on campus. A few schools do, but none that have a kiln that I know of.
So you're doing something else with a lot of it. How are you using it?
So our trees on campus are a teaching resource. So we've had students that have been proposed to underneath these trees. They study. They enjoy their shade. It's a great resource that we have. And traditionally, you know, trees are chipped up there, and they were put into the power plant on MSU, but we've tried to get away from that. And so with our kiln and mill, we are reclaiming the lumber, and we've created a unique line of products called MSU Shadows.
So what kind of products are these?
We have dining room tables, cutting boards, pens, wine bottle stoppers, Christmas ornaments. We kind of run the full gamut of
you
products.
You got a whole catalog, it sounds.
Oh, yeah,
like.
yep.
So you're selling these at the MSU surplus. How do people know about them? How can they see what you're talking about without actually showing up on, you know, auction day or whatever it is that MSU surplus has?
So the MSU surplus store, we have all the products in the store. So if you are on campus and you want to stop by, Tuesdays and Fridays are sale days. And if you want to browse from the comfort of your couch, it's MSUShadows.com.
Oh, you can order online?
Yes.
Oh, wow, that's cool. So what kind of prices are we talking about? Give me a range of three products and an idea of what they might cost.
We have some pens. So our pens are running about $30 to $60. We have a couple different styles.
What do we mean pens? Like ornamental brooch pens or?
Writing pens.
Writing pens, okay.
So we have a bigger one. It's got really nice I want to say guts is not really the word we want to use, but
internal workings.
Yeah, so the internal parts through the pins are of a higher quality, and the wood we use is a little bit higher quality. So those run about $60, and we have another style that runs about $30.
And what about like a table? I mean, how big of a dining room table are we talking about? Are they smaller than that?
Oh, so we have dining room tables that run about $1,200. And then we also have some live edge coffee tables that are around $600-$700.
Got any tags on these things so we know where on campus these trees came from or the wood came from?
No, we don't. So
there's what you need. Because you were talking about their first kiss under a tree or something like that. That might actually be something you can market.
That's something we're kind of growing into. We hope to grow into doing that eventually. So all of our trees on campus are cataloged, and I know where the lumber comes from. But that does not follow through the products currently.
I want to ask you one other thing that's related to this. There was a big move to make sure that all the ash trees that were killed by the ash borer were used rather than just burned. I mean, that was in every city in the state. It seems we have a tree-killing pest coming through every few years, wiping out a big part of our forest. How much does that contribute to the loss of trees at Michigan State University and the state as a whole?
Well, pests is a big problem. So the emerald ash borer is the biggest one in everybody's memory currently. So that's been here since the early 2000s. So since then, we've learned how to treat the trees through pesticides and whatnot. So we can save individual trees in city municipalities and on campus. So we've slowed down the rate of pest trees. Now, if a new pest comes in that we're not prepared for.
Right, because we're seeing some kind of pine blight now.
And
years ago, of course, it was chestnuts and then elms, and then it seems like there's something all the time that we have to worry about. Well, I'm wondering, you know, it seems like the only way we can stop this is stopping exports, especially, you know, Great Lakes shipping. I mean, I don't know what else you would do. That or come up with a lot of good pesticides.
I mean, a lot
which is
of our,
not a great solution, actually.
Yeah, a lot of our pests come from overseas, unfortunately. You know, the Asian longhorn beetle came in through Detroit on raw shipping pallets. So.
Right. That's Dan Brown. He's the wood recovery specialist at MSU's Department of Forestry. And again, we'll put that website that he mentioned earlier on our website, and we'll let you know how to get a hold of some of these products. Thanks for coming in.
All right. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The news came in today that a family we've interviewed on this program, at least two members of the family, have been deported.
It's very devastating. I honestly don't think anybody would like to be separated from their family.
Their attorney, Brad Thompson, joins us now. Give us some background on who this family is, how they got to this country, and why they've been deported.
So Susanna and Sarah and our U.S. citizen daughter were originally here in the United States. Isabella, the youngest daughter, has epilepsy and was born in the United States. Sarah and Susanna are both citizens of Mexico. And their most recent entry was in 2014, where after suffering from extortion, they fled to the border and requested asylum, where they were paroled into the United States and were put into removal proceedings in the Detroit Immigration Court to request asylum.
I want to stop you there because it seems to be the dispute between you and U.S. officials. You say they were granted asylum by a Border Patrol agent. They say she came to the country illegally. So where did that dispute break down?
So specifically, she was never granted asylum. She came to the border and had a credible fear interview where she was found to have a credible fear. But in order to obtain asylum, the immigration judge would have to grant asylum in this case. Where we are in difference with the government officials is that the government officials are claiming that Susanna was a priority one for removal, according to the November 20, 2014 memo, specifically stating that Susanna and her daughter were an alien apprehended at the border or port of entry while attempting to unlawfully enter the United States. Now, if I read the law black and white, she came to the border and requested asylum. Technically, she was inadmissible upon entry, and so the government officials are making that argument that because she didn't enter with a visa, even though the U.S. officials let her into the United States, technically the government is arguing that she unlawfully entered the United States.
So the bottom line is, this morning, Susana Bernabe Ramirez and her 16-year-old daughter, Syra Hernandez, were deported this morning. That leaves the 11-year-old Isabella here in the United States. Who's caring for her?
Her grandma at the, for the temporary moment, the grandma, also the community in Washtenaw County, especially the Washtenaw Interfaith Council for Immigration Rights, has reached out, and there's been a huge community involvement to help take care of Isabella. And that is a great question. That's what we're trying to figure out. I mean, this unfortunately is a sad reality of working in this type of profession, is this happens where families at the last moment really have to figure out what to do because the decision comes at a last moment. And so right now Isabella is living with her grandma, and we're working together as a community to make sure that all her needs are met as best as it can be met.
So Susanna and Syra, there's no appeal. They're out, right?
Correct.
That's a difficult situation. How is Isabella feeling about this at this point?
I cannot even imagine how she feels right now, having had her older sister and her mother deported. So I really cannot answer that question, but it breaks my heart. So I can't even imagine what she's feeling right now.
So what does this tell you about immigration law in the United States?
What it tells me is we're in a new era of enforcement. Ever since November 2014, ICE, especially here in Michigan, has enforced removal much stricter according to their enforcement priorities.
That's Brad Thompson. He is the attorney for Susana Bernabe Ramirez and her daughter, who were both deported this morning, but leaving behind U.S.-born Isabella Hernandez, who's in the care of her grandmother in Ypsilanti. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. $160 a year. The Michigan Catastrophic Claims Association collects that amount for every insured vehicle in the state. It's a law. Some groups have been trying to squeeze the MCCA for some more information on how it sets that fee, but today the Michigan Court of Appeals says that information can remain private. Michigan Radio State Capitol Bureau Chief Rick Pluta is covering this. So, Rick, what's going on here?
Well, this is money that's used to pay the medical bills of the most catastrophically injured people in car crashes in the state. They also have the most expensive medical bills. A group of trial lawyers, hospitals, advocates for injured victims, they sued the MCCA under the State Freedom of Information Act. That's because the MCCA was created by an act of the legislature, even though it's run by insurance companies. And those companies say that the MCCA is not a public body. It's a private corporation, and so it's not subject to the Freedom of Information Act.
So created by the legislature, sets fees for the public who drives to pay, but not covered by the Freedom of Information Act. Is there a wrinkle here? Is there a wiggle room?
Well, the Court of Appeals says the MCCA was created by the legislature. It's empowered to charge this fee. Normally, this would be a public body that's covered by the Freedom of Information Act, except the legislature did pass a law exempting the MCCA from FOIA. And this challenge says you can't change what's covered by the Freedom of Information Act without actually going in and changing the Freedom of Information Act, that law. That's not what the legislature did. It passed a different law.
So someone who wants to know what's covered, what's exempt under FOIA, can't just look at the law and know that?
Exactly. You would have to know where else on the law books to look for it. And the challengers say that's really complicated and not how it's supposed to work.
Transparency. So what's next?
Look for an appeal to the Michigan Supreme Court.
That's Rick Pluta, Michigan Radio State Capitol Bureau Chief. Thanks, Rick.
You bet.
Stateside's producers are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, and Lindsay Scullin. The executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.